Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with personal technology expert David Pogue, founder of Yahoo Tech and science host on PBS's Nova. They'll discuss the potential of technology from fitness trackers to wearables and smartwatches with EKGs and fall detectors to be game changers in healthcare. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa or any smart speaker to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with David Pogue, founder of Yahoo Tech on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with David Pogue, the founder of Yahoo Tech, a technology news website run by Yahoo. He's also a columnist for Scientific American and a host of science shows on PBS Nova, as well as a longtime correspondent for CBS's Sunday Morning. Previously, he was the personal tech writer for the New York Times for 13 years and started writing for Macworld back in 1988. He's also written a number of tech-related books, over 3 million books in print. He's won 4 Emmy Awards, 2 Webby Awards, a Loeb Award for journalism, and an honorary doctorate in music. David graduated summa cum laude from Yale with distinctions in music. David, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. 30 years ago, you started writing for Macworld, and the distinction is one of the most prolific writers and observers of technology. You're a great piano player. You've had this impressive run with the New York Times, writing the paper's most popular columns, Pogue's Post, and State of the Art. And then you took this chance and you launched a tech platform at Yahoo. So you've got wisdom.
well, that's debatable.
So tell our listeners about the major trends you're watching, and we're particularly interested in the transformations that are going around in healthcare as well.
Well, I think the one thing that affects both standard gadgetry that I look at and healthcare technology is the rise of the cheap little sensor. So everybody says that the innovation of the iPhone in 2007 was, you know, it doesn't have keys, it's on the internet all the time. And I feel like what a lot of people miss, inside that tiny little phone you have tilt sensor, proximity sensor, light sensor, barometer, there's an altimeter, gyroscope, compass. There's like 35 tiny little sensors in your phone. And these data that it collects can be intertwined and compared and associated in all kinds of fascinating ways. And that's definitely true in the world of consumer health electronics now. You know, that I'm reviewing a Garmin fitness band right now that's no wider than a rubber band, and it not only tracks your heart rate and your sleep and your activity, but also your stress levels, your blood oxygen. It's insane what they've packed into this. And so the big rise of sensors, and that leads to the second huge trend, which is big health data, the ability to collect gigantic amounts of data from millions of people very quickly, ways that have never been done before a couple of years ago. And all of this leads to a movement, I've heard it called the quantified self. You guys, have you ever had Eric Topol on your show?
Oh, yes, oh, yeah. A good friend.
Yeah,
I love this guy, yeah. And his book is so brilliant. It's called The Patient Will See You Now. And it's about how the power of the doctor-patient relationship is shifting. So the doctor is now not the ivory tower of knowledge, and we're all, you know, at his or her feet. It's more transparent. We have some of the information now, but overall, it's an amazing transformation that we now have insight into our own health in a way that we never had before.
Well, David, on that note, you covered Apple's recent annual product launch event, and amid all the expected fanfare, healthcare definitely seemed to be, I would say, the most prominently featured in the year's announcements. We've had Apple COO Jeff Williams, a former guest on the show, and he unveiled an Apple Watch that not only offers a EKG component, but a fall detector and other health-related features. Maybe break down those features a little bit more for us and tell us whether you think they might be game changers. And I'm going to tell you, I'm sure they're going to be game changers, and I think it's not going to take very long, but love to have your opinion.
Yeah, I mean, the people who knew what was happening in that audience, I mean, you could feel this electric murmur. Take, for example, atrial fibrillation. I mean, as I understand it, AFib is the world's most common heart rhythm problem, and it leads to a lot of strokes and heart attacks and kidney disease, and I'm reading even dementia. The problem with atrial fibrillation is that the way you test for it is at a doctor's appointment with special equipment at the hospital, but AFib is intermittent. This quivering happens only sometimes, so you might go have the test and the doctor won't see it. So the fact that now there's a device that's on your wrist all the time and can detect atrial fibrillation when it happens, I mean, it could save thousands and thousands of lives. I mean, then there's an EKG, so there are sensors on the back of the watch against your skin. There always have been, but now they've hooked that up electronically to the crown, the little knob on the side that you turn. So when you put your finger on the crown and open this EKG app and hold still for a couple minutes, it will actually generate, you know, a classic EKG graph that you can submit to your doctor. They're saying it's the first over-the-counter, direct-to-consumer EKG device. I'm not sure that's quite accurate, but it's certainly the first one built into a watch. That's amazing. And then the one that I guarantee will save lives is the fall detection. So when you fall, it's a very particular motion that your arms do, whether you fall forward or backward. You know, it's sudden, your arms go up, and so the watch has an accelerometer in it, which is a three-axis motion sensor. So, of course, it can tell what kind of motion your body is doing. So now if you fall, it says, wow, looks like you've had a sudden fall. Are you okay? And if you say, yes, I'm okay, then life goes on. But if you don't respond within a minute, it starts sending out texts to people you've designated as your loved ones. And if there's still no response after a couple more minutes, it calls 911 for you and sends your location all automatically. And we know that for older people who fall when they break something, they're, you know, a lot of times it's the end. It's a big deal. So many people fall when they're older. So this is the ultimate, you know, I've fallen and I can't get up device, and it's on your wrist all the time.
You know, I think that's a really good point, certainly for many people who might be dealing with falls. Actually, Margaret, we had a great bright idea a while ago.
Oh, right.
That somebody had developed a inflatable belt,
right,
that also picked up the sensors, and because you don't want to break your hip,
right,
when you fell, it would
inflate
yeah. the belt around your waist.
I'm still waiting to see.
We haven't seen it yet. So, but that's you start coupling those together, and you might have something interesting. And certainly, we obviously admire Apple. Jeff Williams was there suggesting the watch would be the intelligent guardian of the galaxy, or I guess of the wrist. But you know, I guess the big question is, if they're off, it's going to be, sounds like great business for cardiologists. What do you think consumers' uptake will be on something like this? And these, the really the changes that are going around in technology, what's your sense about consumers' appetite? And not just those of us who really listen and watch the work you're doing or jazzed by it, but just the regular folks out across the country.
Well, so here's the problem, in particular with the Apple Watch. First of all, it's not a huge seller in the first place. I mean, yes, you see it on the East Coast and the West Coast, but, you know, Apple still doesn't release the sales numbers. I'd say it's nowhere near the popularity of, let's say, an iPhone or a MacBook Air. The second problem is that the people who need this health monitoring most are precisely the older people who don't want to deal with a tiny electronic gadget that's mm-hmm. very complicated
right.
on your wrist that's hard to see without glasses, and you have to take this thing off to charge it nightly. Is there, you know, is there a grandmother or grandfather in the world who's going to take off her watch every night to charge it and then put it back on in the morning, let alone the fact that when it's off, when it's charging all night, it's not guarding your health. So there is a big disconnect, I think, between the complexity and size of this tiny device and the people who need it most. My dad's 90, and we did get him going with a Fitbit, and he, wow, does he love that thing. And some of the Fitbits, they also have some of these more sophisticated sensors. They haven't turned on the feature yet, but stuff like the atrial fibrillation detection, that's coming. And this Garmin that I'm looking at right now, it has a feature where if it sees your heart rate spiking for more than 10 minutes when you are not exercising, it alerts you. And that's super smart, because if you're just sitting still and your heart starts going, that's probably something. And you know, these are much simpler devices with much longer battery life and much less difficult to figure out. So even if Apple Watch is leading the way, I have no doubt it will trickle down into simpler gadgets.
Well, David, I'm glad you raised the question of Fitbit, because I was just about to ask you. Unlike the East Coast, West Coast phenomena, Fitbit is everywhere. They were smart enough to come up with designer bracelet-like wristbands. I read an estimate recently. We may have now 150 billion hours of data from all of these tens of millions of wrist-mounted devices that have been collecting heart data, among other things, for years now, and that there are researchers who are beginning to do a deep dive into that data. Maybe talk with our listeners a little bit about what they're finding.
Yeah, well, this is wild. Fitbit has indeed now collected 150 billion hours worth of human heart data. And because Fitbit knows your age, your weight, where you live, your activity level, how much sleep you get, it knows all this about you. So the press release said, we've now collected 150 billion hours of heart rate data. So I contacted the PR people and I said, so wow, because you can correlate it to all that other demographic information, I bet you guys could come up with some amazing insights on the relationship between heart rate, resting heart rate, and our health. And they're like, oh yeah, I guess we could. So it hadn't even occurred to them. So they offered to give me an exclusive deep dive into this stuff, and it was just an amazing ride. They put their top two data scientists onto this, but they sifted through all this data and came up with these really cool correlations, some of which are brand news no one had ever heard before. Others were confirmation of things that much, much smaller heart studies have done. So this is data collected from people who own Fitbits. So these are people who have the money to own a Fitbit, mm-hmm. and who care about their health enough to buy a Fitbit. And this is all resting heart rate data. They explained to me that your resting heart rate is sort of like a thermometer of your overall fitness, because it incorporates so many things, like your body mass index and how much exercise and your age and your gender, and all of that is reflected in your resting heart rate. So there's some really cool observations that came out of this. One of them is that women have higher resting heart rates than men across every demographic. And their data scientist says they don't know exactly why, but they think it's because women tend to be smaller, and therefore they have smaller hearts, and therefore it needs to work harder to make the blood circulating. It doesn't totally make sense. So we don't know. This is all new news, so no one's looked into why yet. Another thing they found that I thought was really cool is that your resting heart rate steadily goes up as you approach middle age, and then after about 50, it steadily goes down the rest of your life. And that's something we really didn't know about, and we're not sure exactly why, but one theory is, you know, you have kids. you get busy, you eat worse food, your exercise program falls away, you're stressed out all the time. And also, you know, your metabolism naturally slows down. That's why we all gain weight in middle age. But then the question is, why does our heart rate drop after middle age? And they had a great theory for this. 30% of us in the United States are on beta blockers. We're all on blood pressure and heart attack meds. And that affects our resting heart rate. It's an artificial effect.
We're speaking today with David Pogue, the founder of Yahoo Tech, a technology news website run by Yahoo. He's also a columnist for Scientific American and a host of science shows on PBS Nova, as well as a longtime correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. Previously, he was a personal tech writer for the New York Times. You know, another thing I'm just really excited about is obviously, the whole issue about voice-activated devices. You've got Amazon Alexa, you've got Microsoft Google in it. And really, I think what's unnatural is keyboards. And I'm wondering what your thought is as you sort of connect, you know, those sensors you were talking about, the big data. Can we start thinking about the home as a place where healthcare can be delivered? You've got video, we've got monitors on, you've got this ability to transfer knowledge and data and not patients, right? It seems like Alexa or voice-activated assistants might be the vehicle to do that. We hear that the Amazon folks have a whole team dedicated to finding ways to use this in healthcare, but what's your sense about this? Is it overblown or is it still too early to see the promised land?
No, I'd say it's underblown. I'd say it's underhyped.
Good.
There's this entire industry that the tech industry has been following, the Internet of Things.
Yep.
I can't stand that term. It's like, I will put on my jeans of blue. Like, nobody talks like that. It just means putting Internet connections into everyday appliances so that you can control them with your phone, right? Turn on the lights, open the garage door with your phone, set the thermostat from your phone. And they just kept coming out with more and more stuff in this category, but nobody was buying it. You know, how many people do you know have the voice-activated vacuum cleaner? So the problem was that you had to open up an app on your phone every time you wanted to turn off the gosh darn lights. So it was just not effective. It wasn't efficient. It was slow and clunky and complicated. So that's the real shock of this Alexa business, is that it has saved the entire remote control gadget industry from itself. Because now there's no app. You just say, turn on the lights in the living room, and that's it. You know, play Beethoven in the bedroom. Well, I guess Barry White in the bedroom. It is revolutionary. And think of people who have trouble with motor control, who have trouble with mobility in the house, who are old, who have fallen. I mean, there are 1,000 ways that being able to voice control your environment saves everything. In fact, the news I heard about Amazon just this week is that they have 8 new appliances coming out. There's a microwave, dishwasher. They're actually building Alexa into the devices themselves.
Perfect.
And already they've got something like 15,000 companies building Alexa into their devices at the Consumer Electronics Show. They were demonstrating an Alexa-enabled house, so you could say, is the dryer done yet? So it is getting better really fast, and it is spreading really fast to every other kind of machine there is.
Well, every time we have one of these conversations, I think of all the parents who named their child Alexa in the last decade,
oh my,
who are really seriously thinking about changing that name. But you know, I love your riffs on all of this. Let me ask you to sort of think about the science side of things for a minute, and not what we wear, but who we are, and the whole advance in genomics and people, in addition to knowing their fitness and who they are genetically and in combination with their habits and ancestry and so forth. So I wonder if you follow the All of Us precision medicine work and what your thoughts are there in terms of the degree to which that is also going to inspire people to change their health habits, engage in better preventive screening habits and the like. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I feel like we have very much been in the era of data collection. Like, all these devices are just scarfing down petabytes of data a day. We're not really figuring out exactly what to do with all that data and how it's supposed to work. They're out of business now, but there was another fitness band, the Up Band, and they had this really great idea. They were going to integrate all of this data that the band knows about you, your activity, your sleep, your age and weight and gender and all that stuff, and it was going to start offering observations that you would have no other way to know. Like, you know, we noticed that when you work out in the morning, you tend to have more deep sleep that night and things like that. And it never really came to pass. And, you know, the Fitbit does a little bit of that. It'll say, today you got the most exercise you have all week, but no one's really doing the correlating. And the parsing of this stuff really hasn't begun yet. Yes, we're all talking about the future of super personalized medicine. Could not be more exciting. So yeah, so I feel like we're just at the dawn of this stuff. But because the data is the first step, the parsing can now begin.
You know, speaking of the future, we're seeing a lot of new disruptors coming into the marketplace. Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan Chase have pulled together a partnership. You've got Google's parent company, Alphabet, launching projects, promoting tech-enabled interventions. You know, we think about this in terms of, can you build things that are efficient, effective, elegant? And, you know, in healthcare, you want them to be economical as well, right? You know, you've got this whole group of folks coming really from the Silicon Valley side into trying to disrupt healthcare. But healthcare, you know, 40 years ago, we were doing banking around the world. You are better off yelling down the street to the hospital about your health record than having it sent. Do you think really the healthcare industry is ready for all this great talent, all this excitement? What are you seeing on the horizon about healthcare innovation and integration of this technology and this new future applications?
We haven't really talked yet about data and privacy. And these guys are the villains right now, the Googles and Apples and Microsofts. These are the guys collecting data willy-nilly and sometimes sort of stomping roughshod over our expectations. So in that regard, we have to be careful and we should be wary. I personally am not like that. I'm like, take my data, tell me cool stuff. And I have a feeling that, you know, as us older people grow up and die off, I think this the younger generation tends to be, you're going to give me free stuff in exchange for my data?
Great. I'll put it on Facebook for you.
Exactly. So that warning said, I do think they stand a great chance of improving healthcare systems, these big Silicon Valley companies, for a couple of reasons. One is because they're commercial for-profit entities and they have this gigantic incentive to come up with useful things that work, that touch a lot of people, because they're money-making outfits. I mean, the government's going to have trouble, I think, coming up with a brilliant healthcare system that suits everybody because they don't quite have the brain power that is attracted to for-profit startups and stuff, and they don't have the same motivation to do it, other than getting elected or whatever. So, I mean, I'm doing a story right now for Yahoo Finance about SpaceX. SpaceX is this, you know, private version of NASA. It's a commercial company, and they are now able to get rockets and satellites into space at 1/3 the cost of the government, of any government. Mm-hmm. Right now, SpaceX is the largest launcher of rockets in the world. And they got there so fast because they're private enterprise. They have the money to attract the talent, and they don't have the red tape, and they have a fire lit under them. So in that regard, I do believe that having so many smart minds on the problems with such a great incentive to get it right is very promising for the future.
We've been speaking today with David Pogue, the founder of Yahoo Tech and a host of science shows on PBS's Nova, as well as a long-term correspondent for CBS's Sunday Morning. You can learn more about his work by going to his website, davidpogue.com, or follow him on Twitter at Pogue, and that's spelled P-O-G-U-E. David, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today and your very optimistic look at our future.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you so much for the chat.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump, on several occasions, has taken credit for making Medicare, quote, stronger. In fact, Medicare's finances have worsened since he took office. The latest Medicare trustees report says the Medicare Part A trust fund, which covers payments to hospitals, will run out of money by 2026, 3 years earlier than projected just last year. That's partly because the tax cut law that Trump signed last year will reduce Medicare revenues and increase expenses. Medicare remains on an unsustainable path. The annual cost for all four parts of Medicare, including physician payments and prescription drugs, is expected to more than double from $710 billion in 2017 to $1.44 trillion in 2027. And general revenues from the federal government will increase as a share of Medicare financing from 41% in 2017 to 49% in 2032. In one instance, Trump said that Medicare would be $700 billion stronger over the next 10 years because of growth. But economic growth is not expected to help the program as much as he claims. The Congressional Budget Office in April estimated that economic growth could increase all payroll tax revenues, including Social Security, by $92 billion over the next 10 years. That's far short of Trump's $700 billion figure, which he said was just for Medicare. The Medicare Part A Trust Fund spent more on hospital payments than it received in income from 2008 through 2015, the latest Medicare trustees report said. Although the fund had a slight surplus in 2016 and 2017, the trustees say deficit spending will return this year and accelerate in the coming decade, exhausting the fund earlier than expected. Why? The trustees say part of the reason is the tax cut law. It repealed the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act, which required people to have insurance or pay a penalty. The repeal is expected to increase the number of uninsured Americans, and that, in turn, will increase Medicare disproportionate share payments made to hospitals that serve large populations of low-income people without insurance. Also, the tax law reduced federal income tax rates, and some trust fund revenues come from income taxes on Social Security benefits. With lower tax rates, there's less income from the taxes for Medicare. The Bipartisan Budget Act of 2018 also eliminated the Independent Payment Advisory Board, a 15-member board created by the Affordable Care Act to reduce Medicare costs. The board had not yet been formed, but was supposed to reduce the growth of spending in the future. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Fitness trackers have become all the rage, especially among upwardly mobile, fitness-conscious people seeking to monitor their own health. But another trend has emerged in the age of wearable devices. After a few months, about a third of users simply stop using them. The reality captured the imagination of Tufts University School of Medicine professor Dr. Lisa Gualtieri.
And I thought, what if you could take all of these abandoned trackers and give them to the people who could benefit most from them?
She thought, what if we could get disinterested owners to donate their used fitness trackers to be repurposed and donated to underserved populations?
A lot of the work that we've been doing has been with older adults, racial and ethnic minorities, and for a lot of people, the cost is prohibitive, so I think that that's a barrier.
So in 2015, she launched Recycle Health, an online social media campaign to raise awareness for her program, which seeks donated wearable devices to provide these expensive devices for free to those in need. She partnered with organizations working with low-income adults, seniors in fall prevention programs, and veterans as well.
What we do is talk to people about how active, how sedentary they are, and coming up with a reasonable goal. They might start off with 3,000 steps as their goal, but they know how to make that higher when they're ready to.
Recycle Health, a simple repurposing of personalized wearables, providing these tools for free to vulnerable populations, empowering them to improve their own health. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.